let's come up this other strand. You first heard the word Gordon Conference when?
I think the first Gordon Conference I went to was in probably about 1972. Was on the Tetra Paroles Gordon Conference. Since I had done my graduate work on metalloporphyrins, I thought that might be a useful place to go. Turned out the meeting didn't have anything to do with anything I was particularly interested in, and I never went back, I think, to another session of it. At that time, they were principally interested in the biosynthesis of porphyrins and the organic chemistry. And there was little or nothing in heme proteins or metalloporphyrins or geochemistry of porphyrins or anything like that.
So how did you get into that conference? Just by application?
Yeah. I mean, it's that's the way all the meetings work, is to attend them, you have to apply. It's always been like
that. Why were you accepted, put it that way?
Well, that's another, you might say, a dirty little secret about Gordon conferences. Most of our meetings are not oversubscribed. So I'd say about two-thirds of our meetings, unless there is some, probably is one meeting every other year that a chair will tell me, you know, there's a crank out there that I don't want at this meeting, so I want to look at every name, even though we're not oversubscribed. But, you know, we get 18, 19,000 people a year that come to the Gordon conferences now, and most of them, the application acceptance process is really a pro forma thing, that, you know, the people are not going to turn down somebody who wants to come if there is space. For the third that are oversubscribed, there are a few that are very heavily oversubscribed. They might get 350 applicants.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for that person to pick 140, 150 people that be permitted to come is very demanding.
Let's just stay on that tune for a moment and say the economics of the conference were best when you're 100 plus. How many conferences is that not true of today?
Well, our range of participation will go from maybe 70 to 150. Our economic plan is actually pretty well insulated in several ways, in that all of our sites, our contractual agreements are that we pay for the people who sleep there on a per night basis, and that's it. So if we get 70 people at a meeting site, I don't incur any particular costs. My overhead, of course, isn't as favorable, but I don't incur any huge costs. Then the other thing that we do is we provide each conference with a chair's fund. And this year it's $22,000, but if a conference draws fewer than 100 people, then for the next meeting of that conference, we scale it down to a percentage basis, which insulates us from taking a continuing loss on a small conference.
So the risk has been transferred both to the lodging institution and to the individual conference.
People
so
other than me.
was that true at the start of your watch?
Yeah. Well,
do you know when those changes occurred?
Because
they're very
Alex.
Alex
always. All of Alex's arrangements were on a per night per person basis. They used to give every conference that met got the full chair's fund. And a lot of discussion in the Board of Trustees meetings when I arrived was that we're losing money on this conference, we've got to get rid of it. And my argument was that we should look at the science, not only the bottom line, and that I was quite willing to protect, you know, the economic integrity of the meeting, but I hated to take some place that was really excellent, vibrant science and say, you got to get out of here because you're 15 people short. So we came up with the scaled chairs fund. And the idea was that they would share the risk, if you will, that if they're really keen to do it and I can give them $18,000 rather than $22,000, you know, that's still not a trivial amount of money. And that if they're willing to conduct their business and, you know, hold it with that level of support from us, and it's great science, then we can work with them. Mm-hmm.
Let's go.
We have some sites that are more friendly to small groups, so we can.
Okay. And just say on the conference size, you said, you know, conferences with as many as 350, i.e., they're very popular conferences. Can you enumerate what some of the sexy conferences are today?
Well, medicinal chemistry, I think, had 350 applicants this year, but that meeting has been taking place at least since 1944 on an annual basis, so it's been sexy for a long time. Angiogenesis has drawn some really big numbers. I have in our statistics, you know, I can give you a listing of all of our conferences ranked by number of participants. Whether I can give it to you ranked by number of applicants, I'm not sure. But they're mostly in the biological and biotechnology area where you will get the really large turnouts. We started one on combinatorial chemistry a couple of years ago. The first time that met, it had a pretty good, pretty large turnout.
Oh, I was going to ask back, taking you back to the first conference you attended. You said the topic wasn't what you quite expected. Did you actually leave, or did you stay the full week?
Oh, no, I stayed the whole week, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And most people stay a whole week. We have a little bit of a bell-shaped curve. We now, the meetings used to have people arrive on Sunday, mm-hmm. and the first sessions were on Monday morning, and then they went through Friday noon. And we found that the Friday morning participation was pretty low. It would be maybe down to about 60% or fewer. So we phase shifted forward and start them now on Sunday evening, since people are there anyhow on Sunday, and they finish up Thursday evening and people leave first thing Friday morning. Mm-hmm. And we run about 85% on Sunday evening. That will peak on Monday in the 90s, mm-hmm. and then tails back down, and Thursday night it'll be back down around 85% of the registered people will be sitting in the room listening to something going on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A lot of people we talk to say, you know, they went to a conference and fell in love with GRC. Did you go to later ones after that initial one, or were there?
No, I've gone to probably one a year since about 1972, either every year or every other year. I've been to metals and biology every time it met, probably between 1974 and 1986. Mm-hmm. And organic geochemistry and a variety of other topics. I gave up going to ACS meetings about that time. Okay. And I don't think I've been back to one since. Which I always found them to be the. I've always found Gordon conferences yeah. to be a very very friendly place to. My wife would never go to a Gordon conference with me, no matter where it was, and she said, why should I go there and be ignored for a week while you can sit around and talk about things I don't understand with other people? Mm-hmm. And we get very few guests come to Gordon conferences, maybe two or three. Mm-hmm. And they're just very intense and focused. And
These were New England conferences you were going to?
New England, California. Metals and Biology regularly met in California. This is up at the old site in Santa Barbara. This is Santa Barbara.
How did you fund them at the time you were at Howard? Fund your own attendance at them?
Well, this is something that I always thoroughly enjoyed about the Gordon conferences, is that they were always something that I could pay for myself. Okay. You know, and many times I went to my, you know, if I had spent all my money on my students and things like that, particularly for the New England ones, I would, I was living in Washington, D.C. then, and I would leave Silver Spring, Maryland about 5 a.m. on a Sunday in my car and drive up to New Hampshire and get there about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And, you know, it was, again, it was sort of like $150 semester tuition at Hopkins. I could always afford $150, $200, whatever the registration fee was there. I certainly was not taking bread out of my children's mouth. And I suspect I usually paid for it out of research grants, but if I didn't, that was not a, the cost was not an obstacle to me personally. And I doubt, again, being from Howard, if any chair prior to the one that I founded ever paid my way.
Why'd you say being from Howard?
Well, it's not part of the...
You weren't sexy enough to be...
Right.
Yeah, okay.
So it's the mid-70s. You've now begun attending several of them, either every year or when they're meeting on two-year cycles. Mm-hmm. When did you first chair a conference?
Well, I founded the Energetic Materials Conference in, I think it's about... is it 88?
Yeah. Is that a euphemism for explosives?
Well, it covers all of high explosives, or one particular class, then propellants. There are other things like thermites. And so there are a lot of different types of metastable materials, if you will, that can go anywhere from bang to fizzle to burn. I mean, black powder is an energetic material, but it's rarely a high explosive. Mm-hmm. Ammonium nitrate is an energetic material.
Can you talk in some detail, Carl, about setting up a Gordon conference? I mean, you know, why did you want to? Who did you work with? What was it like? What are the problems? Can you live through that?
Well, when I was at Los Alamos, I worked quite closely with a fellow named Dick Miller at the Office of Naval Research. And Dick was a very good program manager at ONR. I think he's passed away now. But we used to sponsor maybe one or two meetings a year, mostly at Los Alamos, for the energetic materials community on different aspects of it. So we jointly sponsored one down at New Mexico Tech, and then had about 100 invited people, and talked across a pretty wide range of different aspects of the chemistry and physics of that was mostly high explosives, I think. And at the close of the meeting, and this is frequently an entree to a Gordon conference, there was this kind of upwelling of opinion from everybody who was there that, boy, we've had a great time. And it was a week-long meeting and everything. Why don't we see if we can make this into a Gordon conference? And myself and Tom Brill from the University of Delaware were fingered as the people to do it. So I wrote a proposal and sent it in to
to the Gordon conferences.
It turns out at that time there was a fellow on the Board of Trustees, I think who was the chair of it, who was at the Office of Naval Research. He was between two different oil companies, so he was quite interested in the field. And he probably had a lot to do with its being accepted, although I didn't know him or know that at that time. I think he was probably a fortunate synergism there. And it's still meeting. It's been successful.
Do you know who that was?
It was... Now these are the board chairs, right?
Yeah.
That would be on the same page. This guy did chair the Bob Griselli, Robert K. Griselli.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And who's in Munich now, I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But he had left oil company out in Ohio, was doing a stint in ONR, and then went up to Mobil. But I think he had a lot, probably had a lot to do with it. And then we had our first meeting at New Hampton School, and it's still meeting every other year. It's been reasonably successful.
So what about the financing of that first conference?
Well, again, the chair's fund comes from the Gordon conferences, and I'd say about half of our meetings do not have any financing beyond the chair's fund that we give them. I did get some money probably from Los Alamos and Sandia, a few thousand dollars. Most of the people that are involved in that field are from places like National Labs and the Department of Defense, so having support to come to it is not a big deal. They can usually, the labs, mm-hmm. if they'll let them come at all, will pay for it. And actually, at the end of the week, I was walking around the halls looking for people that... you know, might need some money. And there was one guy there who was on his way. He had left a job at Princeton and was, in fact, moving to New Mexico Tech and had been too bashful to ask for any support. And when he found out I would give him $200, he became my friend for life.
Now, in the initial proposal for the conference, how did you frame it? What sorts of things go into such a proposal?
Well, this is quite specifically outlined on our website, but okay. We keep it as simple as possible. Basically, the person gives us a mock program, and they do not have to confirm this with the listed speakers or anything. You know, this is the subject title, these are the 9 sessions, and these are the people that I would ask, and this is what I would ask them to speak about in the best of all possible worlds. And so somebody who's thoroughly familiar with the field, I think, can probably do that in 2 hours. You know, and then they give us a CV. They solicit a half a dozen letters supporting it,
mm-hmm.
and give us the names of some referees. So the normal proposal, you know, depending on how carried away they get with their CV, you know, might only be 6, 8, 10 pages. And I advise them to be realistic, that if they give us a proposal that's got 8 Nobel laureates on it, our board is possibly going to question their judgment as to whether they can actually deliver it.
Right.
But also, you don't want 16 assistant professors. Probably, you know, there's a middle area of well-recognized people, a few people from the National Academy, things like this, and you make a good, credible proposal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we send it out. And one thing that we really look for is that we don't destroy another Gordon conference by doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And often you'll get an unhappy clique from one who wants to go off and start their own because they don't feel they've been sufficiently recognized, you know, within one that is more or less addressing that fee.
Mm-hmm.
Like I spoke earlier of the Tetra Paroles Boarding Conference. Well, we recently got a proposal from a minority woman in Nebraska to start one on cobalamines, vitamin B12. And we had just gotten a proposal from another minority woman in Texas to start one on heme proteins. And these are both going to be competing head-on-head with this Tetra Paroles Conference that's been around since the early 70s. But we're going to be in a hard position not to not to be cooperative. So,
so you would typically that be peer review from neighboring conferences.
Yes.
And then there's the selection committee.
Yes. The selection and scheduling committee and the board of trustees jointly look at these and decide, you know, which ones. That they want to start, and then it's up to us, largely Jerry, to decide where they can fit into our schedule.
It sounds let me caricature it a little and say it almost sounds as if headquarters is just a super efficient post box.
Well, I often refer to us in my talks to the Gordon conferences as their innkeepers. And that's basically what we're the innkeepers for the organization. We try to keep everything organized and running smoothly. Every conference is self-governing internally. They elect the future chairs for their meeting. They administer their own money. And I try to stay out of their business. I don't micromanage their, you know, I don't review their programs. You know, I say, you've got this block of time at this place. You must stay within that block of time. You know, you cannot start at 7:30 in the morning and go to 11:30 at night because I haven't rented the goddamn halls for those times. But what you do within those blocks of time, if it results in excellent ratings from your peers, then probably will be continued in good form. If it doesn't get good ratings from your peers, then you will probably be discontinued.
What about this territory of, you know, new areas of science, areas that quote unquote need a Gordon Conference?
Well, there are like I worked for probably 3 years to get one started in quantum computing, because it seemed to me this was a fairly obvious area. Mm-hmm. It's not a community that we really are well known in, and it really took, I thought, a terribly long time before I found actually a woman at Berkeley and a guy at UC Santa Barbara that would give us a proposal. But that was kind of a low-key, low-level. We got one started in malaria a couple of years ago, and I called up, I sent an email to the guy who's the head of the NIH then.
Varmus?
Yeah, I sent Harold Varmus an email because they had had this meeting in Dakar. And reading about that in Science, you know, it sounded like, so I sent him an email that would a Gordon Conference in this area be useful, and to my utter and total amazement, I got a response from him about 2 hours later. So, yeah, good idea, why don't you talk to, and gave me the name of one of his lieutenants there at the NIH. I talked to that guy who sent me to a woman up at the Harvard School of Public Health. And 3 months later, we had a Gordon Conference on malaria. But that's a small part of our business. But we're not adverse to targets of opportunity, just that we don't do aggressive top-down management.
Do some suggestions of this kind come out of the board or out of the selection and scheduling?
They can, but they would more likely go to one of their colleagues and say, why don't you send in a proposal like this? And just recently, the board, within the last year actually, has decided that they should survey the our total inventory, if you will, of meetings and look for holes. Mm. And we're in the process of doing some of that now. Mm-hmm. And the what you might call the highest level governing body at the Gordon Conferences is what we call the Council of the Gordon Conferences. So once my board gets this query put together, then we're going to send that out to this nearly 400 people that are on this group and see if they have any suggestions.
Mm-hmm. 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 Do you sense any change in all of this compared with your predecessors and the past as known to you?
Change
in degree of thinking about and seeking to stimulate possible conferences?
I think it's qualitatively the same. Mm-hmm. And I clearly work for this 12-person board of trustees, and who makes that up, you know, is going to change. Like a current member is Jim Bristol, who's a very quite high up in the Pfizer hierarchy. And a couple of years ago, he said, "Boy, we don't have a strategic plan," you know, and this is pure corporate America. a year later, we had a strategic plan. Mm-hmm. And it certainly is a useful thing, but I suspect unless somebody like Jim is around who will take a continuing interest in it, that, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, we probably will be functioning on a less formal basis on that. And as board members express interests and concerns about different areas, then you take more interest in those, if you know.
Mm-hmm. Back to the energetic materials, you organize it, you propose it, it's accepted, you hold it. Well, where was it?
New Hampton School up in New Hampshire was the first meeting.
And did it work?
Yeah, it worked out pretty well. And we had a good participation. We had people from national labs, from the Department of Defense, universities, and a couple from industry. And it's still continuing. It's been renewed year on year. It went through a little bit of a hiatus in the mid-90s as, once peace broke out and the funding for all those things dropped down. This year they had quite a good turnout, and I think there's, again, more interest in, in those subjects. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you just chair the first one, or did you stay on as
chair? You can only chair a Gordon Conference once.
Have you chaired other ones?
No.
No. Okay.
No. People are welcome to chair as many different Gordon Conferences right. as they get elected to.
Mm-hmm.
And we have people that I'm sure have chaired at least a half a dozen. And you could chair the same one as long as there's a decent interval between them. And I might suggest that's 10 years or something like that. But the back-to-back chair of Gordon Conference, today we would not permit that out of this office. Mm-hmm.